Hello, and welcome to this week's Arab Digest podcast. I'm William Law, editor of the Digest. Arab Digest is something of a rarity in Middle East analysis. Our daily newsletter has no sponsors, and we carry our podcasts without any advertising. It is our readers who support Arab Digest, and we intend to keep it that way. To find out how you can support a truly independent voice in the Middle East and North Africa, head to arabdigest.org. When you go to the website, check out how you can receive our reader-supported daily newsletter for 2 months for free. You heard that right, 2 months for free. In this world of information overload in which we all find ourselves, Arab Digest keeps it simple. With one article a day and the weekly podcast, we feature unique coverage of the Middle East and North Africa, featuring the very best experts, analysts, writers, and commentators. Essential reading, essential listening, and no overload. My guest today is Lina Khatib, an associate fellow with the Middle East North Africa program at London's Chatham House. Lina, great to have you back on the podcast.
Thank you for having me back. Always a pleasure.
The pleasure is mine. The world's media is currently consumed by the war in Gaza, but there is scant coverage of the broader impact it's having on the countries of the Levant, a region you are very familiar with, Lina. Now, I'm going to do an audio map, if you don't mind. So a mind map of the Levant. At the top of the map is Syria. Below Syria is Jordan. To the west of Jordan is Israel and Palestine. And just up the Mediterranean coast from Palestine and Israel is Lebanon. So let's begin with Lebanon. The IDF and Hezbollah are exchanging sporadic fire across the border. How likely do you see that escalating? And what are the factors that would cause that escalation to happen, Lina?
I have been saying since the beginning of the conflict that chances of all-out war between Israel and Hezbollah remain low. And I still think escalation in that sense is not likely. What I mean by full-on war is something like what happened in 2006 when there was war between Hezbollah and Israel. What has been happening instead is a widening of the geographical area that Israel has been striking in Lebanon. So in the beginning, Israeli strikes in southern Lebanon were only a few kilometers from the border. Now they've, you know, struck in areas near, for example, Baalbek, which is in the Bekaa Valley, and further inwards in southern Lebanon. And equally, Hezbollah's own rockets and rockets launched from Lebanon that Hezbollah doesn't always claim, but, you know, are obviously launched with tacit agreement with Hezbollah, at least, have also intensified over the last few months. But I think here the situation is one in which Hezbollah knows that it is not in its interest to provoke Israel into full-on war, and Israel is in exactly the same position. The way I see it is Benjamin Netanyahu benefits from this war in Gaza, plus what's happening with Hezbollah being extended because of his precarious political situation in Israel, because he has court cases for corruption against him, and he doesn't want to face that. So the longer the war goes on, the more he can, in a way, represent himself as a war hero. But it's not in his interest for there to be full-on war that will lead to vast destruction in northern Israel, for example. So everybody is really pushing things as far as they can, while also being mindful of the boundaries. And here we have to remember that the U.S. has also very explicitly told Israel that full-on war with Lebanon is just not a scenario to be entertained. Mm-hmm. So I expect this dynamic to continue for the foreseeable.
Okay, well, look, Hezbollah is probably the strongest and most coherent force in a country where the economy is ruined, the politics are paralyzed, and the elite do what they do best, which is look after themselves while the people suffer. Just to entertain me, if you will. What would happen to Lebanon should the Israelis embark upon an invasion? Would the country just collapse? Is that why the Americans are saying, don't you even think about going in, Israel?
I mean, for the U.S., it's not just about Lebanon collapsing. It's also about the U.S. needing then to be involved because Israel can't be fighting wars on two fronts as far as the US is concerned. So there's no way they're going to, you know, have Israel fight Hamas and at the same time fight Hezbollah in an all-out war manner. If mistakes happen, and this is the thing, you know, my analysis and kind of likely scenario is based on the most probable way forward, but it doesn't mean that mistakes can't happen. If something happens and all-out war does kind of occur, then Lebanon would be completely devastated. For instance, in 2006, very early on, Hezbollah was assuring its supporters in the south about compensation for losses incurred in the war. Hezbollah can't do that anymore because Iran is struggling financially, and Iran is a major donor for Hezbollah. Arab Gulf countries are no longer going to come to the rescue and turn on a tap without any conditions the way they did in 2006 when they supported reconstruction in Lebanon after the war. And Lebanon itself is basically a bankrupt state. So the whole of Lebanon will be devastated. And that is why there is so little popular appetite in Lebanon for war with Israel.
And what about Hezbollah? I mean, in terms of their support in Lebanon, is it slipping now more than it has in the past? Or is it seen because it's, to a certain extent, supporting Hamas in Gaza? Where is the support level for Hezbollah?
I would say the core support for Hezbollah remains intact, but the outer layer support is eroding. Hezbollah has, you know, talked the talk without walking the walk. So a lot of people feel that this engagement in the war that Hezbollah is conducting is not really changing the game for Hamas. It's not really weakening Israel to the extent that it's now accepting compromises. So a lot of people are saying, well, what for? What has Hezbollah achieved except make people in southern Lebanon and elsewhere vulnerable? And also the economic situation means that Hezbollah can't extend significant support for people other than card-carrying members of Hezbollah. The others get some benefits, but nothing at a very high level. So even the economic kind of benefit of having Hezbollah is lessening to a lot of people. And a lot of people also see Hezbollah as being the primary actor responsible for the political stalemate in Lebanon now. And all this means that, you know, a lot of people who would have at least been agnostic about Hezbollah's power in Lebanon are now feeling that this situation is not working in Lebanon's favor. However, this does not mean that there's going to be any kind of popular or political movement against Hezbollah. And that is because of the extreme weakness of Hezbollah's opponents in Lebanon. So unfortunately, once again, my projection is just continued stagnation.
Okay. Let's look now, Lina, at Syria. And, you know, I sometimes think that Bashar al-Assad and the Israelis have this unwritten agreement. From time to time, the IDF hits the IRGC and other selected sites in Syria, and Assad keeps his nose out of it. Any truth to my assumption?
Yes. I mean, for the longest time, Israel regarded Bashar al-Assad as a convenient opponent to have. Because he, you know, would tell his people that he's going to liberate the Golan Heights, but not take any actual actions that would lead to such liberation from Israeli occupation. And therefore, Israel tolerated the presence of the Assad regime for the longest time. This situation is not, however, forever. The situation now is one in which Syria has become a kind of free-for-all when it comes to Iran-backed groups just running around, launching attacks on, for example, U.S. bases in northeast Syria. You have Hezbollah moving freely in Syria. This is, of course, helping with Hezbollah's own rocket attacks on Israel from Lebanon, because Hezbollah also, you know, still trains troops in Syria and gets its weapons through Syria. So Israel may begin to have a reassessment of the situation and whether the perseverance of the Assad regime in power is actually in Israel's favor. And if that were to happen, then this would have a significant impact on dynamics in the region, specifically regarding Iran-backed groups.
Yeah, and I suppose we'd see that in the stepping up of Israeli attacks on IRGC targets in Syria, which would have a knock-on impact for Bashar al-Assad.
I mean, yeah, Israel has so far been mainly dealing with the situation through targeted attacks to weaken the military capacity of Iran-backed groups, specifically the IRGC, but also Hezbollah targets. Every now and then, there are, quite significant attacks outside Damascus, for example, recently on Hezbollah targets by Israel. But again, for Israel to completely shift what it's doing, it needs the U.S. on board. And this is where, of course, we have to think that there is an election year right now in the U.S., and now is not the time for any significant shift in U.S. foreign policy. So let's see what happens once the new administration is in place.
Yeah, and let's see what happens too with that fraying relationship between Netanyahu and Biden, because the Americans clearly growing more and more exasperated with Netanyahu's prosecution of the Gaza war. Iran and Syria, the so-called Shia Crescent, has received a fair amount of scrutiny, but what about Russia? And right now with the war in Gaza, are they strengthening their position in Syria?
Well, you know, in a way, the war in Gaza has come to balance out the war in Ukraine for Russia. Of course, the war in Ukraine is a priority for Russia, but Russia never needed to lessen the extent of its involvement in Syria to accommodate what's happening in Ukraine. And that's because Russia's presence in Syria is actually quite minimal at the level of military commitment on the ground. So they've been able to kind of handle both quite well. However, interestingly, now with the war in Gaza, it's the Iranians that are getting busier, such as Iran-backed groups and Hezbollah, because of what we were just talking about, the Israeli strikes. And in a way, this helps Russia, because even though Russia and Iran are kind of on the same side in Syria, Russia does benefit from a weakened presence for Iran in Syria. So a weakened but continued presence at the same time. And so in a way, the situation right now is pretty optimal.
Yeah, and
for Russia, I mean.
Yeah, for Russia, yeah. And there again, we see Putin, you know, securing his assets in Syria, and as you say, with not a lot of commitment, either financial or military.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. Basically, Syria has been a very low-cost way for Russia to assert itself vis-a-vis the West.
You're listening to the Arab Digest podcast with me, William Law, and Lina Khatib, an associate fellow with the Middle East and North Africa program at Chatham House. Arab Digest is a truly independent voice on the Middle East and North Africa. No advertising and no sponsors. In the information overload world in which we all find ourselves, Arab Digest keeps it simple. One article a day and the weekly podcast from top experts, analysts, writers, and commentators. Check us out on ArabDigest.org. When you go to the website, be sure and look out for the offer of a free 2-month trial to our reader-supported daily newsletter. Okay, let's look at Jordan, Syria's southern neighbor, which is often seen as a stable monarchy. Is that in fact the case, or is King Abdullah facing ever more pressure, the threat that Palestinians could be pushed out of the West Bank? This is the vision of Itamar Ben-Gavir and the extremist ministers in Netanyahu's government. Mohammed bin Salman looking to seize custodianship of Al-Aqsa. There's drought and a country severely compromised by climate change. So just how stable and secure is Jordan right now?
I would say it remains stable and secure. However, it has faced real challenges because of the war in Gaza. And that is because a huge number of the population in Jordan is of Palestinian origin. Second, you have the geographical proximity with what you've just said, the extreme right in Israel talking about pushing Palestinians further into Jordan. This is not something that Jordan will accept in any way. So the Jordanian monarchy and the Jordanian government have been working really hard to prevent the domestic situation in Jordan from becoming unstable. We have seen, for instance, the Jordanian foreign minister make very critical statements vis-a-vis Israel in the public domain. We have seen Queen Rania of Jordan also appear in the media to talk about the same issues. We have seen a suspension of some of the agreements that Jordan had made with Israel regarding water, for example. So Jordan is aware of the popular sentiment, inside the country, and it doesn't want instability to happen. And it's also doing all this while being very engaged diplomatically with Egypt, with Israel, of course, and with the West. It's really trying everything it can to prevent the situation from kind of spinning out of control. So far, that is working out. It all depends on the US and how it manages or not to kind of rein in some of these outrageous scenarios that the Israeli right talks about, such as pushing Palestinians into Jordan. But because the West is invested in Jordan as a kind of stable island in the Middle East, it is in no one's interest to see Jordan fall apart. And so I expect that this kind of situation about Palestinians being forcibly displaced into Jordan is not something that the US or the UK or European countries are going to accept.
And what about the this idea that's been floating around that Mohammed bin Salman is still very keen for normalization with Israel, but he's setting his terms. And one of the terms could be the custodianship of Al-Aqsa, which, of course, is now the Hashemite kingdom and the ruling family in Jordan has custodianship. Is that a cause of any sort of anxiety?
The only way that would happen is with the agreement of Jordan. If you look at it from a strictly religious point of view, obviously, Saudi Arabia is the custodian when it comes to, the holiest sites of Islam, the birthplace of the religion. And so, in a way, they could use this to say, well, this is a legitimate framework for why it is Saudi Arabia that needs to be the custodian. If they do that, it's not going to be without agreement from Jordan itself. But this would be a huge shift because custodianship of Al-Aqsa is one of the few leverage tools that Jordan has. So you have to think about, okay, if Jordan says, fine, let's give this up, what are they going to get in return as part of this big normalization agreement? The situation is quite complicated and not as simple as shifting custodianship from one country to another, which is why this issue of normalization between Saudi Arabia and Israel is not just about Saudi Arabia and Israel. This is going to be about the region in general, and whatever happens in that regard is going to have echoes and real results all over the region. And Saudi Arabia is very aware of this and is also equally treading very carefully.
Okay. Is there any point at which Abdullah would consider breaking off diplomatic relations with Israel? I mean, would it be if Itamar Ben-Gvir really starts to push even harder on this idea of greater Israel that is driving the Palestinians out of the West Bank?
I mean, if there is a scenario in which actual huge numbers of Palestinians are being pushed into Jordanian territory because of widening attacks on the West Bank, for example, then yeah, this could be, an absolute red line for Jordan that would lead it to break diplomatic relations. Again, right now, the Jordanian government and the royal family are basically trying hard not to get to that point. But they have, especially the foreign minister, on several occasions hinted that breaking diplomatic relations is not off the table.
Yeah, it's a card that they would play if the situation warranted it. And what do you think the impact would be then? If Jordan breaks off, do you think that the Egyptians would follow suit, or is that again?
I don't think so. I think Jordanian dynamics are very much about Jordan. Egypt's calculations are a bit different, but certainly that would be, a very strong message to Israel. And again, Jordan wouldn't do it without coordination with Saudi Arabia and with other Arab countries anyway. And it may well be the case that, you know, if Jordan takes the step, then this could be a message sent by key regional actors to Israel. So it could be part of a wider kind of calculation. If that were to happen, we also have to think about the UAE's own agreement with Israel. So again, it's not a step that Jordan will just unilaterally take. Also, as I said, because of Jordan's very, very close relationship with Western countries, mainly the United States and the UK. So again, these steps are not taken lightly. They're not just, you know, expressions of anger at the spur of the moment. They have very, very wide regional repercussions.
Okay, now finally, Israel and Palestine. The Palestinians are paying a horrific price, but what price are the Israelis paying? And will it ever be enough for them to end the war and agree a fair and equitable two-state solution?
It all depends on who the Israelis decide is going to lead Israel. Right now, they have voted for Netanyahu and a government that has a lot of far-right elements, and this is what they're getting. A lot of Israelis obviously feel that this is a war worth fighting, and that's because of the unprecedented horror that Hamas inflicted on Israelis on October 7. So it's going to take, I think, a lot of steps by the international community to reassure Israelis about their safety and security. And that is the only thing that would, I think, get Israelis to wholeheartedly accept a two-state solution and kind of back it up in large numbers. The sentiment right now in Israel is more about fear. It's more about lack of trust, even in their own security establishments. And so, sadly, right now, there is, from what I can tell, just as an outsider observing, that there isn't a popular appetite to talk about a two-state solution yet. Right now, the key priority for people is for the attacks by Hamas to stop, for the hostages to be released, and for Hamas kind of to be dealt with. Now, people differ regarding how that should be dealt with. The spectrum ranges from kind of, you know, accepting some sort of diplomatic agreement all the way to eradicating Hamas with military force. So again, there is no one sentiment regarding that, but definitely I would say the majority want this war to end, but in a way that guarantees security for Israel. And that is, as I said, a very complicated issue.
Yeah, it is very complicated. Again, to an outsider, it's perhaps easy to see, or easier, certainly easier to see than the people who are directly affected by this. But it would seem to me that a fair two-state solution would give Israel the kind of security that they're not going to get by military interventions that they've been carrying on for decades and have flared up and now into this really horrific and extremely violent war that is ongoing.
I mean, this has been an ongoing debate for decades, and it is still not resolved. And it just means that there just isn't enough of an appetite in Israel to make it happen. Because I think there is definitely appetite on the Arab side of the Arab-Israeli conflict. I think the ball really lies in the court of the Israelis. And as I said, it's been decades of non-commitment really to the state solution, otherwise to the two-state solution, otherwise we would have seen it by now. And the situation right now actually is only making it less likely rather than more likely.
Yes, of course, Netanyahu has dedicated his political career to preventing a two-state solution, part of that including his handling of Hamas.
Yes, absolutely. And this is why, you know, I said, let's see who the Israelis decide is going to lead them, because he has not been shy about expressing this sentiment, and yet, you know, people selected him. So that tells us something. I mean, ultimately, Israel is a democracy, and they have chosen Netanyahu as their leader. So now, you know, whether people start rethinking things once the dust settles, once this war somehow starts to wrap up, is something for us to watch.
And we know where Chuck Schumer is, the Senate House leader saying, Netanyahu, time for you to go. And Biden isn't vociferously supporting Netanyahu, certainly in that regard. Very
Well,
good.
let's see who goes first, whether it'll be Biden or Netanyahu. I mean, again, they may say that, but no one can guarantee that Biden's going to be reelected. So again, a lot also hinges upon the next US presidency.
Yeah, it makes this year 2024 extremely interesting, and maybe it's not a strong enough word.
We'll see. It's been a very fraught 2024, and I don't expect it to be any less fraught, unfortunately.
Okay, well, listen, we'll get back to you at some point in the year, Alina. But in the meantime, thank you so much for talking to us today.
Always a pleasure. Thank you, Bill.
My guest today on the Arab Digest podcast was Lina Khatib, an associate fellow with the Middle East and North Africa program at Chatham House in London. You'll have noticed that we bring you the podcast with no advertising and no sponsors. We are a truly independent source for analysis and commentary on the Middle East, North Africa. If you'd like to support our independent voice, head to our website at arabdigest.org, where you can find out about our reader-supported daily newsletter and how to get a free 2-month trial. The newsletter features the very best of MENA analysts, commentators and writers, contributors like Lena. Check us out on arabdigest.org. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn, and search our library of more than 200 podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google, SoundCloud, or Amazon. Our podcast guests provide unique insights, insights you will not find anywhere else. Thank you for listening. I'm William Law, editor of the Arab Digest. Essential reading, essential listening from independent sources.